because it's the thing that helps you discover what is most valuable. And that's, you know, that's what that a priori value framework that we referenced before does. It's, and that's why it's so important that that is constituted properly, or that is engaged with the utmost clarity or consciousness, because it can lead you astray. But, you know, an incorruptible or pristine logos and an incorruptible pristine money is a tool for orienting yourself around greater and greater and greater and greater value. That's kind of the purpose.
You're listening to the Wake Up Podcast with Alex Fetsky, the place where the most dynamic thinkers and practitioners in the world drop truth bombs and contrarian viewpoints to help you become the best version of yourself. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. John Vallis joins me again for part 5 of the Money Messiah series. In this episode, John and I explore alchemy and the Philosopher's Stone. This is one of the more fascinating rabbit holes that I'd encourage you to go down. We explore what is alchemy, what was its pursuit, why is Satoshi considered the alchemist, what is a hierophany, is Bitcoin the Philosopher's Stone, are Bitcoiners modern day alchemists, and why do so many people succumb to Bitcoin derangement syndrome? This and so much more. Remember to follow John on Twitter at John K. Vallis and subscribe to the Wake Up Podcast for more. Enjoy the show. Let's switch gears over to alchemy. This was, so sort of kind of weaving back into the article, this was something that, you know, Breedlove's kind of discussed and obviously Peterson's discussed. And I think the way you framed it in your piece was really, really good. And it ties into everything we're talking about here, you know, alchemy being kind of like a philosophy of transformation, right? Can you answer maybe two questions as we dive into this idea of alchemy? But for those who think it's, you know, just pre-chemistry, and what was its pursuit? I think that's like really important to kind of set the foundation here before we kind of dig a little bit deeper.
Sure. Well, I mean, people think alchemy was like a bunch of guys in the Middle Ages trying to make gold out of not gold, right? Because everyone wants more gold and riches and big titty bitches and all that stuff. And perhaps in certain circumstances that, well, I mean, they were in a sense trying to do that, but it wasn't just a material endeavor. Or at least the outcome wasn't just material. Because, you know, the premise, the philosophical underpinning was that they were trying to perfect matter. And it begs the question, like we were discussing before, like, well, what is perfection? What metric should we be using to ascribe the notion of perfection to something? And the contemplation of that very question throws you down the rabbit hole of, you know, the fundamental nature of reality, effectively. And which is why that, you know, it ended up being the case. And as we said, when you pursue that line of contemplation, you end up coming to a figure like Christ, because you take the truth of God, let's say, and you distill it down into a form that's relatable to human beings so that you can actually use it to orient your perception and your behavior and your judgment and your discernment. And the same sort of thing happened with those guys, because when you contemplate perfection, you need that same requisite system of value and discernment and judgment. And it's almost like the reason why it facilitated the moral development of the adherent of the alchemist is because how can you go through that process and determine what the most valid judgments are without realizing the truth of them yourself? At least conceptually. I'm not saying they all became like perfectly moral people, but it's almost like, you know, the quote that you see the world as you are, not as it is. I can't remember who to ascribe that to, but it's like, it may be the case that we can't understand things beyond the limits of our own understanding of ourselves, let's say. And so if we're looking for these eternal truths, we understand them in relation to ourselves necessarily. And their pursuit of creating the perfect matter, incorruptible substance, let's say, in gold or the philosopher's stone, there's different, like sometimes they were the same thing, other times maybe there was some slight differences. But they were looking for, you know, the eternal matter. You know, and it's so interesting how the internal and the external are related in this way. Like we were talking before about, like, at least part of my philosophy is this eternal aspect of value that everybody has. Again, like we have a bunch of names for it, but let's just say that it's eternal, incorruptible value that every single person has. And as a result of how our internal landscape influences how we see the world, it's almost like we graft on to the world that same value framework. And so when we look out on the world and we see something with commensurate qualities to that thing that we've conceptualized internally, we ascribe value to it. And so, hey ho, like, wow, gold we come across and it's incorruptible. It doesn't corrode. It doesn't, you know, it's pristine, right? And maybe its relation to the color of the life-giving sun, it was, you know, relevant as well. But point being that it's not like gold was predestined to be valuable on earth just by virtue of some of its qualities, but it's because I think it coheres or is linked to the qualities that we ascribe to the thing of greatest value internally too. It's a representation of eternalness. It's a representation of incorruptibility, which is what we were exploring before, right? Like I said, like once we individuate our individual behaviors and in the interpersonal world, we're highly corruptible. All of us, nobody's pristine. But that spark that animates, you know, our life, that thing is pristine and eternal and something like that. And so I think it's seen through that lens. I mean, it's almost not surprising that, well, I think that's what we did. I think we looked out and we looked for the thing that most reflected that same idea that we held internally. And so you might say that a more fleshed out version of that idea of that eternal undifferentiated spark is something like God or Christ, which is why when these guys were pursuing the perfection of matter, it necessitated a greater clarity of understanding of the perfection of the self because of the fundamental link between the two. And so that was the alchemists were looking for that thing that was perfection out in the world. And perhaps by happenstance, they realized that it necessitated clarity and perfection internally. And, you know, I'm sure there's many more details and I'm not the most well-versed in alchemy, but I think that's basically the rub. And the really juicy question is what is the true power of fully realizing that aspect of value of ourselves and integrating that into who we are, into our lives? And maybe this conjures up the notions of like unifying with the mind of God or Christ consciousness or, Samadhi, you know, in the Hindu tradition, or enlightenment or nirvana in the Buddhist tradition, like maybe that's that. And so what is its corollary in the external world? Well, it would have to be this thing that is both full of contradictions, but is also almost a magical substance. And what do you know? The alchemists ascribe to this substance the ability to heal the sick and to, you know, to perform almost these magical functions by virtue of its extreme value. And I think there's something to that relationship between the internal and the external manifestation of value, of the highest value, let's say.
Yeah, there's so many things we can go down there. Like I find this topic just really, really, really fascinating because it's funny how humans from even a couple hundred years ago kind of look back on now, like almost with a disdain. It's like, oh, you know, they were stupid. You know, they didn't know what they didn't know. Like, or I had this actually gripe with the stupid movie, The Eternals. Like, they, you know, when the Eternals first came to Earth, you know, they came to Mesopotamia, and like the way the people there were kind of framed in the movie were these kind of like village, you know, weaklings. And it's like, that's not how fucking ancient man was, right? Like, it's, we are far more weak and fragile today, physically speaking, than we were back then. Like, we fucking survived in the goddamn wild, right? Like, killing shit with our bare fucking hands. It was a complete day and night versus, you know, how we look physically today. But it reminds me of, you know, what you sort of described there as, you know, this alchemical pursuit was, how curious humans were, and they basically have always been, in the kind of grand questions and grand pursuits we were on, which, I don't know, in some ways I feel like we're still on, but we're sort of also not. Maybe it's just the degree of scale, because there is, you know, obviously the population of the world is so much larger that, you know, I feel like you can't go down the road and have a conversation with someone at the bar about alchemy, right? Like, but, you know, what one could probably also argue that the texts that have remained that are about alchemy and asking these questions about the fractal nature of existence, et cetera, and, you know, the incorruptible substance, you know, the texts that have remained are probably from the rare few people at that time who also asked the kind of crazy, whacked out fucking questions that people like you and I are asking today, which is why we're so fundamentally different. So I don't know, I'm kind of going around in circles here, but I find it intriguing, to say the least.
Let me comment on this. My analysis of thinkers, for lack of a better term, from a prior era has been, as we've been discussing, like, I'm tremendously impressed, and I derive a tremendous amount of insight from their work. And in some respects, I think, like, some answers, I don't think they've been nailed. Like, I think some aspects of the human condition have been sufficiently explored and possibly answered. But the thing that inspires me, like, unintentionally, but the thing that, if I reflect on my own thinking and pursuits and stuff, the thing that inspires me to explore whether or not there's anything to be added to that prior work is that notion that the more our representation of our minds is externalized, i.e. in culture and in art and the sophistication of technology and that kind of stuff, I think that puts us in a better position to gain greater clarity or complexity on ourselves in some way. And maybe that means we'll also gain greater clarity or complexity on the nature of the bigger questions. You know, and again, to use the extremes to kind of prove the point, or potentially prove the point, is like the cavemen, right? When they were just outlining their hands, and they were just drawing like therianthropic figures, like a man body and a bull head and that kind of stuff. Like, there was meaning in that. We may not even know what it is now, but like, they did it for a reason, and there was some interplay going on. And presumably at least an element of that was them trying to, even if they weren't trying to explicitly understand themselves, their very act of doing that was like, was part of that process. And through that time, culture complexified. And, you know, first we have outlining of hands 40,000 years ago. And then 2,000 years ago, we have the Bible, which is like fucking bajillions of orders of magnitude more complex than outlining your hand on a cave wall. But the function and the motivation is the same. And so is it the case that the more complexity we bring to the realm of ideas and communication and technology and all this kind of stuff, are we going to be able to better explicate the nature of our circumstance in this reality? And my inclination is the answer is yes. And that's why I don't just, you know, sit back on the couch and say like, oh, well, the Sufis or the Hindus, or the Buddhists or the early Christians, like they figured it all out and there's really nothing more to be discerned. And this comes back to the alchemical point, because even if that were the case, it doesn't relieve you of the responsibility of understanding it for yourself if you want to reap the benefits of the wisdom that was unearthed or discovered in those pursuits, because you don't get to outsource that. You know, because you can't just intellectually know something and have it be integrated into your mind. You must believe it. It must become the means by which you perceive reality for it to become real in your life. And to do that, you need to understand it to the extent possible. And so, you know, we have two tasks in front of us: pushing our understanding of, you know, the big fundamental questions, the nature of our circumstance forward, and then you literally using that as a framework to upgrade ourselves toward having a better life for us and others. And again, that's the fucking hero's journey right there.
Yeah.
And so like there are no philosophers, really. Everyone needs to be a philosopher, because everyone needs to bring that type of upgrade to their framework and their perception. As we were discussing before, most people aren't going to do it. And this creates a, you know, maybe the value of that function in society. But in ideal terms, everyone is very intentional about how the framework of their perspective is constructed. Because why? What's more important than that? I think we touched on this in our last discussion. Like, if you're not in control of constructing your perception, someone else is. And this is how you get led astray. And this is how you give up your life. And this is how you become apathetic. And this is how you lead a meaningless life. If you want to lead a meaningful life, you're extremely intentional about how your perception is constructed and what it means for the beliefs that you hold and the actions that become effortless as a result of that. You know, because you don't have to try to believe something. You just believe it and then you act upon it. And nothing seems more consequential, I guess.
So, two things I wanted to pull from there is, like, one is the idea of you can't pay someone to go to the gym for you so you can get fit, right? Like, it's just not how reality works.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It's the same in the gym of the spiritual realm and the gym of the mental realm. You've got to do the work, and there's that, you know, proof of work idea again, right?
But which is why a lot of like religious people are LARPers, just to throw it in there, because they just like, just by saying I'm a fill in the blank, they think that's the rub, and they can like follow a few things and go to certain, you know, religious events, and like that ticks the boxes for being one of those things, when proof, that's not the case at all. Yeah.
Literally. I've staked my claim to this religion, and therefore I'm pure.
Yeah.
Bullshit. So yeah, so that's one piece. And then I also love this idea that, yeah, the kind of the wisdom of, how do I phrase this? Almost the knowledge of a higher truth, or of the incorruptible substance, you know, or truth with a capital T, has always been there with us. And maybe human evolution has been, as you've kind of said, is like this process of better and better defining that. And, you know, I started off with this drawing of a hand on the cave, and yeah, it emerged into these great scriptures or these great writings, you know, whether the Bible or the Vedic scriptures or whatever. These things emerged as a way to identify, or as you using your word, to explicate that with a higher degree of fidelity, so that more people can take the journey of embodying the hero. And, you know, through that lens, and I've said this in other words, but, you know, Bitcoin is the most high fidelity version. And I'm writing a piece now called Bitcoin Shows You, It Does Not Tell You. And it's kind of the idea that Bitcoin kind of transcends the spoken word. Is like, Bitcoin doesn't have to tell you what's right or wrong. Bitcoin just shows you by, you know, scoring you on your behavior. You know, if you want to transgress, go and by all means do so, and you will feel the pain directly. Like the feedback is in how it manifests directly, not in a story about, you know, hell or heaven. And yeah, like maybe that is like our science, maybe, or our technology is always playing catch up to what we kind of know heuristically through narratives, right? And mm-hmm. you know, maybe Bitcoin is kind of like a quantum leap towards a physical manifestation of what we've known in the metaphysical realm for a long time. I'm having a mind-blowing moment at the moment. Is like, you know, I've kind of called Bitcoin the fusion of physical and metaphysical in the past, and yeah, like the way you've kind of framed it now through the lens of alchemy and everything that you just said is like, it's that.
Yeah.
And whoever's listening to this, we are not on crack, I promise.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why I called the piece Money Messiah, because I came to the same conclusion. Yeah. And in the latter part of the piece, that's basically what I say, you know, like that the word has been made flesh once again with a different substrate. But this time the substrate is not simply an idea that people can hold. And again, like we were saying before, if the ideas are true, it is consequential whether you cohere or adhere to them or not. And I think that is the case. But again, there's wiggle room there. And the same is true for Bitcoin. I think the same principles have manifest themselves in a different substrate. The difference being that this substrate is in the quote unquote physical world. Now, obviously, Bitcoin is kind of more digital than physical, but it's like something that we can interact with and we can verify and we like it's more tangible, let's say. And that gives it perhaps a greater consequence, like it, because the rules, you can still opt out of Bitcoin, right? But again, as you're saying, what are the consequences of ignoring that truth? What are the consequences of ignoring the truth as represented in the archetypal or regenerative hero? What are the consequences of ignoring the truth of Bitcoin? And the answer is, broadly speaking, less optimized life, right? Because that's, if these things are truly true, that's what they're trying to deliver, a more optimized experience of reality or consciousness. And I know optimized would need some definition, but again, that's what these traditions attempt to explicate. They try to put words on what makes a life good, what makes a person good. This goes back to our conversation about like the ability to judge at all. That's what they're for. And Bitcoin seems to be, and like I reference at the end of the piece, like I understand this is a batshit outlandish insane thing for two reasons. One, most people don't even recognize the validity of the hero as it's represented in religious and other narrative. So it's like, it's a complete non-starter from that perspective. And even if they do, it's either heresy or completely insane to suggest that the second coming of Christ, as it were, is represented in a digital protocol named Bitcoin and not in, you know, some Middle Eastern dude coming back from wherever the fuck, or you know what I'm saying? So like, I get that it's completely insane, but if I just, you know, we've been exploring some of the logic in this argument through this conversation, and it seems fairly logical or rational to me insofar as such a thing can. And the question is, you know, what now? Like if that is true, and if we recognize the impact of the human species having grasped the influence, even the unintentional influence on our consciousness of the idea of the hero and how it's represented in story and how it's oriented us and how it's influenced law and society and culture and everything. What happens when it's here again, or it's reemerged in a higher fidelity, more tangible, more consequential, less susceptible to misinterpretation form than ever before? If the values that are represented in both are true, and now we're saying that they're represented in higher fidelity than ever before, then shit's about to get crazy. You know what I mean? Like, maybe nothing is more consequential. And I think a lot of us operate with that sentiment or that understanding.
If we totally sound fucking batshit crazy, and that's I love the way you describe that, because it really is like, but it's also simultaneously a fucking absolute pleasure to like be able to have this kind of a conversation with someone, and you know, have the person on the other end of the conversation not kind of like
call the
walk
cops
away shaking their head like thinking, who the fuck am I talking to? Like it's and that's where I think the value in you know, as much as like, you know, we run these kind of like obscure little podcasts, you know, kind of on the fringe, you know, I think the people listening to this, this is exactly what they're here for. And it's just funny how like you look at what the, you know, the larger podcasts are actually discussing. And I mean, you know, albeit there's a couple good ones out there, like most of them fucking garbage, man. Like I've tried to like listen to some, you know, more quote unquote mainstream stuff, and I'm like, fucking kill me now, please.
Well, cause you just, like we just said, I mean, if I think we're, I don't think either of us give ourselves up too willingly to delusion or indulgence, intellectual indulgence, right? Like I don't care about notoriety, accolade, status, or anything. I just want to know the truth, because my faith is that's the most important thing. And we seem to be pursuing and using logic to pursue whatever ends that logic reaches with the constituents and the data that we have available to us, and the what we're observing and our experiences and that kind of stuff. And it seems to be leading, and we may not be, you know, I don't think we could ever presume to be perfectly right in the assertion that we just made, but let's say like there's something of great significance happening here, and I'm sure we'll develop better language to communicate it and conceptualize it better, but like seems to be something. But what, as we said, like nothing is of greater significance than that. So like I'm with you. Like I, you know, what am I going to, I mean, hate to shit on anybody, but like, what am I going to listen to Tim Ferriss talk to some like anti-aging person? Like, don't care. Like nothing is more relevant than these questions as far as I'm concerned. And so I agree with you. Like it's still very niche. And to most people, I had, when I released that paper, some MMA journalist or something retweeted it. And he was like, his comment was, this is like actually insane. You know, that was his comment. So of course, like we have to expect and be cool with that. And I totally am. I don't give a single fuck about any of it. But it is the case that a lot of Bitcoiners are having these thoughts, and they're coming to similar conclusions, or at the very least, they're very receptive to having these ideas explored at this type of extremity. But every time I get together with Bitcoiners in the flesh, you know, I think Eric, on a recent podcast I did with him, put it in a funny way. I think, cause at the conference he was, you know what he's like speaking loudly, arms flailing. He opens with Bitcoin is the second coming of Christ, right? Rather than like 2 hours of logic first. And you know, like he describes his experience saying this to Bitcoiners, and the response is like, Yeah, I like it. And he was like, you know what that means, right? And they're like, but I get it. You know, like, it's good. You know, so there's obviously, there's something going on. It is like, first of all, there's nothing that motivates me more in terms of intellectual pursuits. But two, like to your point, like I'm extremely grateful for people like you and others that I can have these conversations with, and not only like that requisite humility to like actually want to have a conversation and not just speak over each other and get our points across, but someone who like, when I say the words, they're going to like really get most of them. Like they're going to be able to find the meaning that I'm trying to construe and then put it through their own machinery and come back with something that adds to mine. And like, this is, you know, this is the dialogos, as Rebecca says. This is the whole point. Like, otherwise, we're just jacking each other off, right? We should be wanting to keep passing these ideas through our respective machinery toward getting a greater clarity around these truths. And it's fucking awesome, I guess, is my point.
It really is. So question just on this piece is, do you think this is something that is unique to this stage of Bitcoin's development, Like, do you think there's going to be the John Vallas and, you know, Svetsky and Breedlove and Kaysen equivalent in 5 years from now, 10 years from now, when Bitcoin is kind of quote unquote more mainstream? You know, do you think there's going to be that sort of stuff? Or do you think this is like a phase that Bitcoin has to go through? And for us to get it to that stage of more mainstreamness, a bunch of fucking lunatics like us have to kind of emerge and basically talk about Bitcoin as the second coming of God. You know, what's your thoughts on that?
Second coming of Christ. It's a bit different than God. Yeah. But I think, you know, there's always going to be people on the frontier chewing on the big questions, right? And, you know, in 2140, when the last Bitcoin is mined, we'll know a lot more and we'll have a lot more questions. And I think there's always going to be those that are inspired, you know, to our point, to our conversation earlier about like that relevance machinery, that are always drawn to the relevance of the questions. And, you know, the eternal forces of chaos and order always need balancing. And there's going to be people that explore the best ways of doing so. But I do think it's the case that, because part of our inquiry here is like, our brains are being like, our minds are being so blown by this thing as it emerges in the legacy culture, that a lot of our questions, you know, for all Bitcoiners, I think, is like, we're just trying to come to grips with it. Like, it's not even like, I had no ambitions to be a philosopher. Let's put it that way. Right. And I'm not saying I am one, but like I didn't think it would be taking up that much of my time discussing these sorts of things or writing about them. But I think many of us are just like trying to get a grip on what this thing means for ourselves, for our consciousness, for our lives. And because it's so radical, because it's so profound, simply in an attempt to do that, we're necessarily, you know, first of all, reaching into all the different domains of knowledge and insight and wisdom that came before to try to properly contextualize what's happening. And then we're having to reach deep within ourselves and contemplation and writing and these conversations to get to a point where we're comfortable with the grip. And again, if this really is as profound as we've been discussing, then the very endeavor to come to grips with it is the very transformative process that the alchemists went through and that, you know, religious adepts, you know, the genuine ones went through. And so it's like, it's a very fundamental religious, spiritual, psychological transformative process that's happening within all of us. And these sorts of conversations and writings and all that stuff is necessary to mediate that process properly or optimally. And so I think by virtue of that, there's way more of this type of stuff that will happen now than later, because the fruits of our labor, you know, as we were saying about culture generally, like culture helps you, you know, culture helps you understand how to engage with other people, right? So like it's that cultural conditioning and socialization and that kind of stuff. And Bitcoin, a culture predicated on Bitcoin will emerge. And a lot of the things that we are now discovering, behaviors and insights and wisdom and truths, will be built into that culture in the future. And so they won't all have to be determined and recapitulated to a large degree. They'll be available when you emerge in it. But big questions will remain, and the curious people in that area will take up the mantle, I suppose.
Yeah, so I guess in other words, the kind of archetype that, you know, crazy people like you and I represent will probably move on to asking similar questions, but for different things, perhaps. Like, we just happen to be lucky enough to be asking these questions for something so pivotal in the grand scheme of things, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there'll still be like people that, like, there's still, you know, there was Christian theologians 1,000 years after Christ, for example. And so I think there'll still be like Bitcoin people that, you know, contemplate the meaning and significance of Bitcoin. But I just think it will be less of a necessity for all members of the society to do that, because so much of it will be built into the culture. So it'll take a more curious mind to be that person than, like, because like we said, I mean, even if a lot of the early Bitcoiners were a little bit contrarian, anti-establishment, you know, somewhat outside the status quo, I still don't think many of them thought of themselves as like, you know, deep philosophers or thinkers or whatever. But this is how Bitcoin changes you. Like you had to become it to understand what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, someone was asking about like obviously the classes of Bitcoiners, and I don't mean class in the societal sense. I mean like, you know, we class of 2013, class of 2016, 2018, whatever. And it seems like, I mean, you know, Kaysen and Francis and Pierre Rochard, for example, are examples to the sort of contrary, but it seems to me that like, I feel like, you know, me, you, Gigi, Breedlove, you know, we kind of are all of a very similar ilk. And it seems like we kind of came in through around the same class, right? You know, 2016, 2017, kind of that sort of era. And I was on Spaces a couple of years ago, actually, and I had this kind of thought, was like, why was it that so much, quote unquote, Bitcoin philosophy came out around our generation of Bitcoiners? And I thought that, you know, and tell me what you think of this, is something to do with the cost of Bitcoin and the degree to which we're all in. So, for example, if you were all like, you could have had easy couple hundred or a couple thousand Bitcoin in 2011, 2012, 2013, and it not represent a significant degree of your wealth. Whereas in 2016, 2017, you know, for the average person, you know, going all in on Bitcoin to try and get 50 or 100 of them, like you were fucking genuinely all in, like balls to the wall level of all in, that if this shit, if you were wrong, you were fucked, like wiped out. And I know me, for example, and you talk about this in your article, right? It's kind of like, I think you used the Matrix quote, like we've already chosen, but then we're in the process of trying to rationalize or understand the decision, right? So it's the Oracle's quote. And I feel like the strength of the philosophy that has emerged in the last couple of years has been a result of us being so fundamentally balls deep into it that we've had to fucking figure this out, like to kind of check whether we are actually sane or whether we've actually completely lost our fucking mind. And I think that is it's a unique moment in time because Bitcoin is an economic beast by definition. I don't think there ever will be a time again where, you know, people like us can get a buy into a significant amount of Bitcoin, with, you know, basically an average level of wealth, and be significant Bitcoin holders, because, you know, people like us, like 100 years from now, we are going to be effectively like, you know, lords or kings or noble kind of stature in terms of like the quantum of wealth we actually possess. But we had to basically go all in. And I don't know, it's an interesting thing. I don't know if I've been clear on what I said, but I know.
I feel like I know exactly what you mean. And because I was going to say, like, well, would that mean that, you know, people who went all in 2022 are going to be even more philosophically minded? But as you say, like maybe the gravity of their stack affects, or the size and gravity of their stack affects like the degree to which that's motivated.
Exactly. Yes.
You know, who knows? I don't think there's a hard and fast rule with that stuff. I mean, there's definitely a logic to what you said, that I wouldn't be surprised if it was true in certain capacities or a part of a motivating force. But I think the reason why I use that Oracle quote is because, you know, a lot of us went all in way before we had any of these types of thoughts about Bitcoin, right? I mean, we're just like, it makes sense.
Like intuition. Yeah,
it made sense on a narrow view, like, oh, non-state money and solves the problems of the state, whatever. Sure. Like this is a hill worth dying on. And then like all this additional inquiry into it. I mean, again, many reasons, I'm sure, but part of it must certainly be just like, trying to understand why we made that decision. Like, of course, trying to verify, like, cause we don't want to be deluded, but the decision's like pretty much already been made. And I'm not really poking that much holes in it from a technical perspective. That's somebody else's job. So like what I find in this domain, I can't see how it's going to turn me off of my all-in thesis, right? So I don't think it has that much validity in terms of confirming my choice. I think it's more so trying to understand the choice, like, and trying to understand why it's having such dramatic effects on my consciousness and my ideas and how I see the world and all this stuff. Like, it's an aspect of it is like, what's the totality of the reasons why I made this choice, both conscious and unconscious? Because there seems to be a lot of stuff happening beneath the surface that's being inspired by this thing that I think we're all collectively trying to make conscious so that we can, you know, be more conscious in how we engage in it and communicate it. And also to that same point, you know, the quote I used earlier about we don't see the world as it is, we see the world as we are. Like, for me, it's like a fundamental belief or faith that the more we can come to a greater clarity of these ideas and these truths, the greater capacity we have to bring them into our lives and integrate them into who we are. And there's a profound value in that. Like, again, more value than anything. Like, and maybe the ultimate one is love. Like, to what degree can you bring love into your life and use that to resolve all other internal and external conflicts? You know, and again, love songs and religions and, you know, philosophies, they all try to articulate the all-encompassing or all-healing power of love or something like that. And maybe love is a bad one because it's a bit woo-woo, but you get the point, right? Like, there seems to be a great value in getting greater clarity and understanding of these concepts and ideas and values and principles because of how they affect your life. And as a result, it seems like it's a very worthwhile pursuit to attempt to establish that greater clarity. And Bitcoin seems to be both like the source of that inspiration and the means by which to engage in that process. You know, so both as a tool, as an idea in your mind that's just, you know, that splinter in your mind, to quote, I think, Morpheus, that just won't let you go. And you continuously rehash to try to get an idea of it. And the function of an incorruptible money in the market, again, to this like alchemical idea of inside outside, you know, money is like, and I think Breedlove first introduced this concept, but money is kind of, an incorruptible money is kind of like the logos internally, because it's the thing that helps you discover what is most valuable. And that's, you know, that's what that a priori value framework that we referenced before does. And that's why it's so important that is constituted properly, or that is engaged with the utmost clarity or consciousness, because it can lead you astray. But, you know, an incorruptible or pristine logos and an incorruptible pristine money is a tool for orienting yourself around greater and greater and greater and greater value. That's kind of the purpose. And so those two things seem to be happening. And how could we not engage in that quest? You know, because there's definitely other things in life, but few things seem more consequential than that.
Totally. I want to ask you about Mircea Eliade, because he comes up a couple times in your piece, and you know, I'm always trying to give people new rabbit holes to go down. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, who he was, you know, why some of his work is important, what maybe people can read?
I don't know a tremendous amount about him. I believe he was Romanian. I believe he was active in like the 50s. I think that's when he published his work. He was a religious historian. He was an anthropologist. He was someone who delved into like the philosophical, psychological, mystical aspect of things. The Forge and the Crucible is the book that he wrote on alchemy, which I drew from for this piece. He also wrote a book called, I think it's just called Shamanism, which is about shamanism in various places around the world and the meaning behind it and then why it emerged and its function. And then he has A History of Religious Ideas, which is a three-part series, which I haven't read yet. Actually, Breedlove is reading it now, and he messaged me last night, and he was like, you got to bump this to the top of the list. I think I know what it's going to, I think it's going to be very Eric Neumann, Peterson-esque. You know, I think it's going to be along the lines of what we've been discussing here, but the kind of function, purpose, process of religious narrative and stories. And I've been avoiding it because like each book is like 400 pages and there's three of them. And so, you know, it's just a bit daunting, but I probably will get to it for the piece that I'm currently writing. And yeah, that's been his shtick, you know. Basically, this conversation, he would have been very happy to have been a part of, right? Because it has like anthropological and cultural history. It has, you know, religion and philosophy. It has spirituality and mysticism, and it has alchemy. And that was kind of his bag, as far as I can tell.
Interesting. Yeah, that's who first mentioned him to me. I think it was actually this chick that I was dating in Brazil for a little bit, like 2 or 3 years ago. And she was a bit of a philosophy and history buff. She was an interesting person. I'm pretty sure she's the first one who mentioned his work to me and sent me like a PDF of his stuff. And I read a little bit, but it's like, he's always been on my reading list. And then when I was reading your piece, I was like, fuck, okay, there's that name again.
He comes up a lot with list. Terence McKenna references him a lot. And, you know, like, okay. 20 years ago when I was listening to like Terence McKenna YouTube videos for 10 hours a day, that's where I first got my exposure to him. And then Peterson has, you know, mentions him from time to time as well. And so because I had read shamanism back then, and then I read The Forge and the Crucible, you know, a year ago, and the rest are on the list.
It has a term. I think it was him, hierophanies or something like that, which he used in the piece. Can you talk us through that?
I think the definition, he might have even coined that term, but I think it's something manifestations of the sacred into the world, or like the highest manifestations of the sacred into the world. And I think he would be comfortable with applying this, or maybe he even explicitly did apply this to anything from like an object to an idea to a symbol. You know, again, as we've been discussing, like all that stuff is experienced in the mind simply as an idea or a conception, right? You know, and so why do certain ideas impact us so profoundly and so powerfully, or cause such a reorientation of our minds or perspectives or clarity around values and principles? Like, why? And, you know, I think it's reasonable to assert that there's something more truthful about them than any random occurrence or any other, you know, less significant, less relevant idea. And, I think that's what he means, like kind of breakthroughs of the sacred, when and how they occur in various different forms. And I think I use it in the piece to refer to Bitcoin would be the most sensible. I can't recall right now, but I'm not sure if I linked the two, but I think that was kind of a setup for asserting that Bitcoin, you know, is what it is. But I think it was just basically that our consciousness is tuned to allow for or desire or need these breakthroughs of awe-inspiring meaning into the world, because they need to be upgraded by them. You know, again, we could fall back and be like, well, hierophanies are just the hero in relation to our consciousness, perhaps. Like our consciousness need to be upgraded by meaning. Greater meaning, greater value. And, you know, they pop into the world and they pop into our minds through various means. And I think that's the gist of it there. There's probably more context in the piece. I can't remember right now.
Yeah, it's all good. I'm always intrigued by new words. Like there's a new word that I just learned from Pablo, actually, over at Swan. It's the word is contrapliant, and
I've been seeing that lately. Yeah,
have you?
Well, people put it on like their Twitter handles and their profiles, you know.
Okay, well, that's good. So,
maybe it was you, but I've definitely seen me.
Yeah, definitely me. Like, I've done it recently. So, I mean, I assume you can guess what the fuck it means by the word, right?
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah, well, the idea is that it's like, at least the way I understand it is it means actively non-compliant. So it's not just non-compliant, but it's kind of like, you know, to be actively non-compliant. But I'm actually thinking of changing the name of the fucking podcast to Contrapliant, to call it the Contrapliant podcast, you know, in the, you know, for kind of two reasons. One, because it's got a strong meaning. And number two, I actually own the fucking domain and can own the entire word. So curious, nice. While we're on this, do you think that's a good move, like to move away from Wake Up and to move to something like Contrapliant?
Well, I mean, I'm torn on the issue too, because my fucking podcast is called Bitcoin Rapid Fire and there's nothing rapid about any of the conversations that happen on mine, you know? So, you know, I want to change it to something at least less contradictory, but part of me is like, what's in a name? You know, like, does it really even matter? And the answer is probably like, for people that already know it, no, but for new discovery, potentially. Because people will see the name of a podcast and be like, oh, that's not for me, you know? Now, I wouldn't know what to call whatever it is I do on mine. That would require some thinking. But
slow fire. And long fire.
Yeah.
Extended fire. Yeah.
But with yours, I mean, the only, again, same sort of dynamic applies. The only thing I would think is that, I mean, Wake Up is great because I think it's just so, I mean, so apt for the circumstance that we're in today.
Totally.
And, you know, people have been talking about an awakening of various kinds for a long time, but the downfall of that is that it's like fairly generic.
So whereas 6 billion people with the same fucking name.
Yeah. And Contrapliant is new and fresh. And as you say, it's like, you pretty much know what it's about just by the name. So, I mean, that's the extent of my comments or advice in that realm.
I'm going to change it to Hierophanes with Stephen. Like, what the fuck is this? I need to listen to this. I'll be like, thanks to John Ballas and Mirsha Eliade.
Well, at least you'd have the, like, the curiosity meter going for you on that one.
Totally. I want to read a couple quotes here from your piece on alchemy, which I think are important. And then I kind of want to tie off alchemy shortly. So there was one here, which is the alchemist interpreted reality as having a fractal-like structure, and that therefore truths revealed in the microcosm could be applied to the macrocosm and vice versa. So I love that. I think that was you, or could have been Peterson. I don't know, but I think, you know, for me, that just beautifully illustrates basically the fractal nature of everything we've kind of been discussing. And you know, it to me echoes Bitcoin and its seemingly endless lens through which you can view everything. Like, somehow everything fucking relates to Bitcoin, from food to how you dress to what's in your fucking portfolio to how you should behave amongst people to religion to science to everything. You can seem to sort of view Bitcoin through. So, you know, we've got this kind of one piece there, and then there was another piece that you mentioned in your article. It says what the alchemists were pursuing, the so-called incorruptible substance, was in fact that which represented the principles by which reality could be most fruitfully engaged. That is, that which best mediated or most balanced the forces of chaos and order. It was the same as pursuing the principles of Christ or other central archetypal hero, just in a different form and by other means. Which to me, you know, once again, both of these two things, like, they kind of tie up what we've been discussing this whole time. So where I kind of want to lead that is, I think the answer is yes, but is Bitcoin therefore the philosopher's stone?
It seems, I mean, it seems likely is the wrong word, but it seems to fit a lot of their descriptions, both of the object itself and of how it affected people that interacted with it. You know, because that's why my main focus is is that. It, like, it is learning about how Bitcoin has changed or transformed people. Because, like, who cares about... I shouldn't say who cares, because I am interested in monetary history and economics and all that kind of stuff. But, like, whatever. Like, it's just kind of theory, really. Like, the real...
Yeah, that's, like, impact, the what, not the why, right?
Yeah. The real truth of what's happening here is, if it really is hot shit, like, it's going to affect people's lives. And as you just finished saying, like, if it changes how you see everything. And I would say, like, you know, perhaps there's that element of, like, embedded patterns with embedded patterns with embedded patterns. And that's part of the reason why. But it could be also something as simple as Bitcoin is a profound form of truth. And it permits you to see by its truth more than anything before. Like, so it upgrades your perception in a manner that allows you to see truth more clearly. And that doesn't discriminate. You can see truth about health just as much as economics, just as much about philosophy. Like, it's all truth is truth, right? And if you bring more truth or clarity to your perception, it's you're probably going to notice it in every domain. And I think that's part of what's happening with Bitcoin. And even, you know, to going out on a little bit of a limb here, but I actually think it's less of a limb than it might at first seem. But like the Philosopher's Stone, one of its attributes was that it would heal the sick, right? And the same was true, of course, of Christ, right? Christ could heal the sick. And when I hear the stories of people tell me about how they were depressed, nihilistic, substance abuse, no meaning in their life, poor relationships, bad treating their body poorly, and then as a result of going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole, all those things 180'd radically, right? So like they ended up treating, and you know, I mean, like look at Bitcoiners' approach. A lot of Bitcoiners have become like health bros now. You know, like it's a funny phenomenon, and like everybody, and because they want all those things to be optimized, and so first of all, like on a very material level, those specific domains of what constitutes your greater notion of health are being upgraded, but also to what degree, because you might say, well, okay, that's fine. Like you're healthier and you have better relationships, but like, we're not talking about curing cancer and stuff here. And it's like, well, to what degree does more meaning and more inspiration and more purpose and more happiness and greater community and all these things that this thing is fostering, to what degree do those actually influence the emergence of ill health in the human body? And the answer is definitely to some degree. I don't know exactly to what degree, but the answer is for sure. And this has been studied like in hardcore science to some degree, like your mind has an impact on the health of your body and the manifestation of disease. And so, yeah, I think after this conversation we've had, it would be pretty hard to say, no, the Bitcoin is not another representation or the most real instantiation of the Philosopher's Stone ever, because it seems to cohere with the concepts and notions that people were ascribing to it, both as characteristics of the thing itself and as its impact on people who engage with it.
Goddamn, I was on mute. Yes. So following on from that, there's another quote which I think just ties into exactly what you just said there, which from your article again is Carl Jung refers to these people who are first to encounter such a novelty as the most refined and differentiated minds of the age, who detect emergent anomaly and begin the process of adaptation to it long before the average person notices any change whatsoever in circumstance. So I guess, I mean, what a better Bitcoin definition for Bitcoin is. Like, literally.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, my question here that I've written in my show notes is like, are Bitcoiners the first of the regenerative heroes to undergo the process of internal value reorganization, as per, you know, what you mentioned in the article. And I guess, you know, the answer to that at this point is a given. You know, it's a yes. So I guess, did you have anything to add to that?
No, I mean, I included it because as I'm reading the alchemical literature, I'm reading Jung, I'm like, and again, like as we said at the beginning, the hero archetype can manifest in many forms, right? But I think it is notable when the archetype, well, as we've been saying, if it's re-emerging in a more crystalline or pristine representation than ever before, then certainly it's notable who the first are to recognize that and begin adaptation or transformation through it, you know, adaptation to it or transformation through it. And yeah, I mean, again, you read those lines and you're like, obviously that's what's happening with Bitcoiners. Now, we could be wrong about all this, in which case we would be wrong about that assertion. But if we're right about this stuff, then obviously the people that Jung is describing there are represented in the Bitcoiners of today.
Okay, so as we're saying, Bitcoiners basically are defined by Carl Jung here. And I guess the question I sort of have following this is, and this probably ties into what we spoke about when we first jumped on this recording, is like, do specific people find Bitcoin? Because it seems like Jung describes them here as the most refined or differentiated minds of the age, you know, seem to detect the anomaly. So is there something special about them? So that's part one of the question. Part two of the question is like, you know, does Bitcoin cleanse all those who come into contact with it? So there's kind of two parts there. Bitcoin as the philosopher's stone, I guess.
Yeah, I think there's many doorways into Bitcoin. So there's many like selection criteria, let's say. Like I think broadly speaking, maybe the most basic one is like a curiosity, right? Like if you just accept everything as it is and you don't really care and you just go to work and come home and have dinner, like you just don't have the required curiosity. But you know, you can be a libertarian, you can be a cypherpunk, you can be someone who saw the problems of the world and is looking for a way out. You could be an anti-establishment person. You know, so there's many little hooks that might bring you into the fold. It's hard for me to think that you, well, I mean, people come for number go up, right? So most people are greedy. And then if you end up, and let's say 100 people come in for number go up, bear market, 90 of those go away. And then 10 remain because they're like, oh, well, like, what's this actually about? I was just here to get rich, but like, I'm kind of curious now. And to the second question, I think the answer is largely yes, because anytime, and this relates back to the alchemy stuff, anytime you ask the question, what is this, what is X about? You know, what is the relevance or significance of X? How does X change my perception of the world, of reality, and as a result, necessarily my place within it? And so when you do that with Bitcoin, and if Bitcoin really is as consequential as we've been exploring, reframing or an upgrade of your perception, at least partially, is like almost essential. Now, some people like are far more open, again, to the point about ego, to being upgraded or transformed by Bitcoin. Some people hold on to their conception and identity of themselves, and that restricts the degree to which they are, I think, their perception is upgraded by Bitcoin. And, you know, we see many examples of that in the space. And very obvious examples are people that come in because it's some hot new tech that people are talking about, but they don't like how they're being spoken to because they're usually spoken to with more respect and deference. And as a result, they think the whole, you know, they think everyone's toxic and the whole thing is not as interesting, or the pursuit, they're knocked off their supposed quest for truth. And, you know, those people are just pussies basically. And they're not as dedicated to the pursuit of truth, obviously, because if they can be knocked off it by some meanies on the internet, then it ain't really real. So, and so there's a spectrum of those types of people. And I think the ones that go deepest and the ones that are transformed the most by it are either open enough to all of its implications and are pursuing an understanding of it, and or, as is the case with so many things of such great power and significance, are humbled by it. And that humbling allows them to be receptive to all the different ways that it might impact their perception and their worldview and their frameworks and all that kind of stuff. So I think by and large, the answer is, like, if you really go down the rabbit hole, the answer is yes. But, you know, there's also examples, you know, the kind of Bitcoin derangement syndrome types that, because I mean, there is something to be said. I mean, there's something to be said for something of such great power. I mean, let's put it this way, and Peterson talks about this a lot, but, and we referenced this, you know, earlier in this discussion, but an ideal is necessarily a judge, right? Because that's almost its function. Like you construe an ideal so that you can more properly judge yourself and others, as we were exploring. And with judgment comes pressure, with judgment comes discomfort, because you have the ideal and you have yourself. And to what degree do those things differ? And if they differ, the more they differ, the more pressure I think is felt by the person who is feeling they are being judged by the ideal. And there's two ways of approaching that. One, you could say it's a valid ideal, and the degree to which it's identifying things about myself that are incongruent with it, I'm going to take that as being instructive, and I'm going to try to, you know, burn off those elements of myself or reorient myself such that there's less friction between myself and the ideal because I've adopted its characteristic and let go of the thing within me that was causing the tension or the friction. That's one way. The other way is saying, I don't like being judged. I don't like, you know, I don't want to change the conception of myself. I want to hang on to the comfort of the identity that I've constructed. And as a result, I'm going to reject the judgment of the ideal. And again, we're well in religious territory when we use this type of language, because you're rejecting, you know, you're rejecting Christ, let's say, or you're rejecting God. And in this case, I think it happens occasionally that something of such judgment, such ideals, such virtue, such power and significance can feel like a weight in a variety of ways. And if you don't figure out how to manage that weight, then it can crush you. And some people it does. And it kind of, you know, they go off the rails and they have BDS and that kind of thing. And yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. Like I listed some names here, which is, you know, because it's funny, you went straight to BDS, which was great, because it was the next question that I wanted to ask you. It's like, I've got it in my show notes. What about those who break when they come into contact with Bitcoin? Why did they not transform as we did? Which, as we said, ties back into that original question about nature or nurture. But, you know, there's those that kind of dismiss it, you know, who are sort of outside the status quo, right? Who are outside of Bitcoin. So you've got your, you know, let's say like a Janet Yellen, she ain't gonna fucking say Bitcoin's great, right? Or a Klaus Schwab, or a, you know, someone like that. Or there's that redhead guy on Twitter, like Stephen Deal or whatever his name is, you know, who's like, who's that kind of like nerd who's always arguing about the demerits of Bitcoin or whatever.
I think I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. He's got this kind of like cartoon avatar, right? And, you know, him and a bunch of other prominent, people have just submitted something to Congress denouncing Bitcoin as a dangerous thing to society or whatever the fuck they've just done, right? So you've got those, and we can argue they sort of sit in the, you know, the bucket of, you know, the static egotists who, you know, are reluctant to open themselves up to something new. But then you've got these other people like Roger Ver, for example, who came into contact with the Philosopher's Stone, and he came out the other end a complete fucking retard. Vitalik Buterin as well. Eric Voorhees, he's like one of my greatest like disappointments. Like he fucking got Bitcoin not only early, but so well, so early, and went completely off the rails. You know, Udi, Richard Hart as well, like, you know, scammer of the scammers today, but he genuinely fucking got Bitcoin early on. Taleb is another, you know, another example. So it's, you know, I wonder what that means, and whether there is a nature thing there. Because I've got this picture in my head of like, you know, you have this, you know, Bitcoin's kind of like the, as Knut would call it, the, like the information element or something. Like it's the first
element zero, I think is the term being passed around right now.
Okay. So, yeah, it's this new element and it's kind of like a raw, pure energy, you know, metaphorically speaking. And it's like, if you touch it and if you are pure, you will, as you've quoted Arnold Dillanova, he says there abides in nature a certain pure matter, which being discovered and brought by art to perfection converts to itself all imperfect bodies that it touches. Right. So that's this kind of, alchemical idea that you touch and you come into contact with the philosopher's stone, with this pure thing that you heal in a sense. But these people seem to be examples of like people who burnt under that exposure, like they shriveled, you know, there seems to be movies in which someone touches the sacred substance. It's reminding me of kind of Indiana Jones, right? Like, you know, you touch the sacred substance and you become the king versus you touch the sacred substance and it fucking burns your arms. So I don't know what my question is there other than like, what does that say about our original discussion about people's consciousness level being closer to human or tree? I don't know.
Do you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior? Is my first somewhat joking response. But in that, I mean, like Christ is representative of certain principles, as we've been discussing, and certain values. And do you hold those values to be the highest values? And as a result of that, the ones to which you will subordinate yourself to, or try, or use to orient yourself and accept being judged by. That's what that means when you believe, you know, values are the highest. You're saying, that's what I aspire to. And as a result of that, everything that I do, I'm going to think about in relation to those values that I aspire to, so that I can continuously refine my behavior to make sure it coheres more and more and more with those values. That's the mechanics of that process. And it's obvious that, or it seems obvious to me that certain values and principles are, I guess saying that they're explicit is not necessarily right, but they're obvious in Bitcoin. Truth being one of them, freedom being another one. And again, going back to the point, like, what is the appropriate response to being in the presence of a profound truth? I think you have to, you're humbled by it. And again, this is why it conjures up the notion of like, do you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior? Are you willing to humble yourself to the values represented, the word represented in Christ, such that you judge yourself by them toward becoming a better version of yourself? I think, and the reason why we explore the relationship between Christ and Bitcoin is because I think the very same principles are represented in both, just in a different, you know, in a different form. But I think that the principles of truth and freedom and love are represented in both very obviously. And so I think the same is true. Like, are you willing to recognize the superiority of those values and their representation in this form and subordinate yourself, your ego, to them in order to aspire to be refined by them? Or do you reject that proposition? And I think all the people you mentioned are examples of rejecting that proposition. You know, they all have different reasoning and justifications and all that kind of stuff. But the punchline is, I think they reject that proposition. And again, I think ego has to be a large part of this, because I think oftentimes it's a failure to say, yeah, that the value represented in that thing, or values represented in that thing, are worthy, are valid judges of me, are worthy of my, you know, devotion. And therefore the thing in which they're represented is the most valid or the most useful tool in my own refinement towards those values. And if you reject that, then obviously you're going to ascribe less value to the tool, or you're going to ascribe you're not going to ascribe total value to the tool, and maybe other tools in the periphery you'll you'll ascribe some sort of value to, or I think you fail to fully devote. If we don't want to use the term sacrifice, I think you fail to fully devote yourself to the values that are represented, and you ascribe equal value or commensurate value elsewhere. But again, when I think of those people and I watch the behavior, and like, who am I to judge at the end of the day? So this is kind of douchey, but like, especially in the case of Roger, as you brought up, but in all of them, really. I mean, I think ego is a massive component of them not being willing to subordinate themselves to higher values to use to refine their character. And as a result, attention exists and grows there, and they reject the thing that is causing the discomfort associated with the tension, you know, again, to varying degrees and all that. But I think it's something like that that's going on there.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. I mean, you know, I always question, like, there's you know, different layers of understanding as well, like this idea that, you know, there's cerebral understanding, you know, then there's like visceral understanding, and then there's kind of like, you know, instinctual fucking ancestral or spiritual understanding, which you understand something and you don't even know why you understand it, but for some reason you understand it. You know, it's kind of like in your DNA. It's like, you know, maybe there's an argument to be made that these people kind of understood Bitcoin intellectually or cerebrally, but you know, didn't really choose to embody the values that it represented. So yeah, it's a curious thing. I always wonder, you know, some of those who were just able to so, you know, see it so early, appreciate it, understand it, articulate it, and go off the fucking rails. It's strange.
I mean, two other things come to mind. One is, like, they could also just be like wrong in terms of the logic or reasoning they're applying to things. Now, it's impossible to separate that from like the ego that's kind of inevitably tethered to whatever logic you're applying. So it's not like they're totally separate, but like, people can just be wrong. But to your point, like, it's weird that they were right at first and then had later become wrong. But the other thing, and humility is such a massive component to the pursuit of truth, as far as I can tell. And it's also one of the most endearing qualities in people, because it means that they're ascribing more value to the pursuit of truth, or to the being a representation of the highest values, than they are toward their conception of their self and whatever they may be able to accrue to it. And again, not that the latter is not a part of the equation. It's just a matter of order of importance in the hierarchy of meaning and value. And I think, you know, I explore faith in the article a little bit. And again, that's like another one of these dirty words associated with religion that, like, surely a post-Renaissance modern person, you know, who thinks they're a logical and reasonable thinker wouldn't invoke such a notion, because it's basically like putting on a blindfold and running around on a highway and hoping you're going to survive or something. And I think of it much more as the internal inevitable inability to achieve certainty in anything. And so, you know, in the Austrian school, they have certain axioms, which allows the whole logic of their thinking to, it's the foundation of the logic of their thinking. And to me, it's just basically saying certainty is not available. Okay, what are the limits of logic and reason? Okay, they bring you to whatever doorways or whatever places. Okay, that gap, because, like, knowing that you can't have certainty and knowing the limits of logic, you still need to act. And so what is the logic or the values or the principles that are you going to, that you're going to adapt or adopt rather, to orient your behavior, absent knowing whether or not the outcome is going to be an optimized outcome or the one that you want? There's an element of, you know, moving forward despite having complete knowledge. And I think faith is kind of the thing that we use to allow ourselves to do that. We do our best to come to the to align ourselves with the values and principles and other forms of knowledge that we think will elicit the best outcome. And then there has to be a form of faith that allows us to act on that basis and also continue to act on that basis when the immediate feedback of doing so may not be super positive. You know, so this is where, because that's often the case, right? I mean, you used the workout example earlier, but like, again, this is a oversimplified example, but like next day after a workout, you feel shitty, right? You're sore, you can't walk. It's like, you feel weak, you're tired. That's not why you're doing it. But, and you know, that gets resolved in a couple of days, which is why it's a bad example. But often in life, if you can be pursuing what you think to be the right principles and the results may not be what you want in the here and now, or at least when you expect them to manifest. But if you're aligned with the proper principles, then faith allows you to put yourself in a position to maximize ultimately the outcomes of what are the most significance, but on a timeline that you don't have control of and in ways that you may not be able to conceive or expect. And I think that's partially its function.
Faith is such a big topic, and I have a whole thing that I wrote recently about it. And it's funny, I wrote it recently, and then I read your piece about it, and I was like, this motherfucker was in my head. Like, we kind of viewed the faith piece very, very, very similarly. But I want to save that for the next episode. So I'm gonna I'm gonna park the faith discussion for now, and just sort of say, like, I think this is a good place to wrap up, because we've covered, you know, alchemy and the idea of the philosopher's stone and Bitcoin embodying that thing, and how it relates to the hero archetype. I guess maybe to wrap this up, just two quick final pieces is, are you aware of the etymology of the word alchemy, or why the philosopher's stone was called the philosopher's stone? Do you know anything about that? Or
I looked. Alchemy is somewhat contentious, because I think the ancient name for Egypt was Kemet, and alchemy, as one interpretation goes, was like the science of the mystery schools of Egypt, something like that. But there's an alternative one. I don't know if I included it in the piece or not. It was part of my notes, but in any case, I forget what it is right now. So no, I don't know about that. And no, the etymology of the philosopher's stone, I don't know.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think I'm going to research that before our next call. And then one final thing is, it's funny when you said, do you accept, you know, Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior? It's, you know, I know you're saying that tongue in cheek, but it's really interesting. As you were saying that, I was kind of feeling my body, and I had this like knee jerk, like, fuck you, I don't need a Lord or a Savior.
Interesting. I'll let the listeners interpret that as they will.
Yeah. It's, I kind of wrote here, I was like, no, if you said, do you accept Jesus Christ as your ideal? I would be like, fuck yes. So
is there a difference? Is the thing, because if the ideal and the values wrapped up in it lead to an optimized life for you and the people around you, then is that not saving you in a sense? And is that not, you know, is that not, you know, acting as your Lord and Savior in terms of your Lord guiding you in the right way and saving you in terms of delivering to you an optimized experience of life?
Yeah, interesting how words and meaning, you know, are shaped inside this fucking circuitry in the skull.
And so much of this is so tainted, right? Which is why, I love this shit, and I love you, and thank you. You know, thank you for having these conversations with me, because a part of this culture that we're a part of, and that hopefully is going to become the dominant culture at some point in the future, whether it's 50 years or 500 years, is we have to undo the taint of the current culture, as we've been discussing. And we, you know, if we're pursuing truth, we're going to have to figure out how to approach topics and reinterpret words of the past in the non-default ways. Because, you know, most people are going to hear, "Do you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior?" and have the same sort of visceral reaction that you had. And I've had that at points in my life before. But coming to this different appreciation and understanding of the language involved and the processes involved and the mechanics of value and all these things we've been discussing is far more palatable. And I can see why it was narrativized in that way. Mm-hmm. Because what, you know, perhaps what more powerful language would there be to convey the centrality and the significance of the process that it's trying to describe? And it, you know, maybe the part of the response, maybe it's not perfect and maybe it's not optimized. And I think that's part of our function is like, for whatever reason, we're here now and we're having this conversation and maybe this is relevant in some way. Like, I don't want to ascribe too much importance to either of our work or anything about us, but we're here for some reason, you know, and I don't mean like someone pulling the strings. I just mean by virtue of the maze that life takes and the different ways that you interact with the things that you encounter, like, you know, here we are having this conversation. And I think it seems like relevant or important to me to, well, if we're contributing to a greater, you know, understanding or clarity around some of the most important truths, then removing the bias and taint and all that other stuff with language that's come before, so that we can both for ourselves and other people access the wisdom contained in those words, is a beneficial, you know, is a worthwhile enterprise, let's say.
Absolutely. All right. On that note, let's wrap this sucker up. I'll pop the article again in your in the show notes. I noticed I was reviewing it again, so it looks like you got a few more reads. Did you notice? Like, it seems like people are actually taking the time
on
to
the
read
Substack?
It. Which is, on the Medium actually. What's the most shared one? And where would you actually prefer me to send people, Medium or Substack?
I don't know.
You don't care? Really? Okay. All right. Whatever. I'll put both links in there. All right, my man. Well, look, thank you. Thank you again for jumping on another fucking marathon. I look forward to booking the final two parts of this, and then we can, yeah, hopefully tie this off on a note that kind of gives people a bit of a vision forward.
Totally. It's funny, you know, prior to the call today, I was kind of just thinking to myself, like, what more are we going to talk about? We kind of ran through a lot in the last one. And, you know, now I'm sitting here 3 hours later. I'm like, that was a fucking, I enjoyed the fuck out
good
of that conversation.
Yeah. Dude, I thought this,
hopefully that will be the
funny
case next time too.
I was thinking something similar, honestly. I was like, do I have enough notes here? Like, are we going to get through? Like, maybe there's not enough. And now we need to do another one.
Yeah.
Fucking classic. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate it, man. It's always a pleasure.
Anytime.
Thank you for listening to the Wake Up Podcast. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. I'll try and read them each week and send you a shout out. And remember to grab a copy of the Uncommunist Manifesto and join us in defeating plague that is consuming our world.